So this is the date is February 18th, 2013, and the location is Professor David Finkelstein's home in Atlanta. So it's usual to begin these kind of interviews, oral history interviews, by looking at early family life and general family background and, you know, what your parents did and this kind of thing. So I know, I read your CV online. I know that you were born July 19th, 1929, in New York City. So into what kind of family was that?
Both my parents came from the same small town in Poland, not far from Warsaw. It's called Sokolov.
And
it's just Polish for small town.
When did they come over to America?
Around 1914 or 15.
And did they bring any skills with them? Were they educated or trades?
My father was ordained as a rabbi before he left Poland, but he didn't. And he was offered a seat in New York when he arrived, but he decided it wasn't for him and went into the grocery business.
So whereabouts did they live in New York?
My babyhood was in Brooklyn.
Right. Okay. So, did they have any kind of scientific interest or mathematical interest at all? Or did they have an interest in, you know, learning about science?
No. And my mother read a little in behaviorism.
Right.
Studied languages. But not science, no.
But do you have any brothers or sisters?
Could I?
Any siblings?
No.
So you're an only child. So you lived in Brooklyn. So you went to your first school was in Brooklyn.
Public schools.
Yeah, which school was that?
The earliest one I remember was near Lackmish Avenue. And I don't even remember the number of it any longer.
So were there any people at that school with you who went later on to, was it Stuyvesant?
Pardon?
Were there any people from that early school, or from where you lived, who continued on with you to later life?
Well, every time, my parents moved rather often.
Okay.
As they advanced from one store to another. And that always involved a complete new set of friends.
Ah, okay. Did you display anything even? So what age are we talking? In primary school?
I migrated to New York City, Manhattan, at about the age of 12.
Okay, and then you went into Stuyvesant?
First I went to Joan of Arc Junior High School and then to Stuyvesant.
Right. Okay, so before you went to Stuyvesant, had you displayed any mathematical or physics-based kind of skills?
I was ahead of my class in mathematics and behind in language.
Do you remember any particular books that got you interested and excited?
I was asking my algebra teacher questions about calculus while I was at Joan of Arc. I suppose I must have gotten my hands on Sylvanus P. Thompson, Calculus Made Easy, because that's where I learned calculus from.
Yeah, that's the famous Feynman one, isn't it? What one fool can do, any fool can do.
Ancient Simian proverb.
Yeah. Excellent. So you mentioned that particular teacher. He must have...
Mrs. Reinhardt.
Right, so must have taken an interest. Was there a bit of an influence?
Well, she was just a lively woman. I don't think she paid any particular attention to me.
Yeah. Okay, so, and then on to Stuyvesant High School. Was that competitive back then? It's kind of competitive to get in now. So you had to...
There was an entrance exam, and they skimmed.
Yeah. And... So
I'm very grateful to the New York public school system.
What date are we talking for your entrance there? Do you remember? Do you know?
1946.
To enter Stuyvesant. Is that right?
I spent 3 years there, 46 to 49. Wait, no, I'm sorry. That was City College.
Yeah, that's good.
46 to 49. So Stuyvesant must have been like 42 to 45.
Yeah. So right, obviously slap bang in the war years.
That's right.
So do you remember that happening? Do you remember what happened to the teaching staff? Did anything switch around? And
I distinctly remember the Sunday when the headlines said war. The Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. Yeah. That was when I was still living in Brooklyn.
Okay. That was, yeah, December 1941. Did you have as a teacher Melba Phillips, by any chance? She was there, right? Was she there?
I didn't know that. Where? Stuyvesant or?
Maybe it was City College of New York. I'm not sure which one. I think it was Stachel who. I'll need to check that actually. I know she was at one of those. So I read somewhere that you were friends with Jacob Schwartz quite.
I think of him as my best friend. We went through high school and City College together.
Okay, so what kind of interactions did you have? Were you challenging each other with math problems? Were you reading books together or teaching each other?
We talked in high school, and in City College, once or twice we took honors courses together, and we would have study sessions. Jack had the theory that you could get by with the least sleep if you broke your sleep up into a batches of a couple of hours. So we would sleep 2 hours, read as long as we could, sleep 2 hours.
I tried that.
And I went through Vay's algebraic geometry that way.
While still at high school? This is in college, but you were friends with him in high school as well, right? So do you remember what kind of things you were discussing in high school? What kind of topics or what was getting
you
excited?
I dredged up some memories for the In Memoriam that I contributed to the volume. I distinctly remember riding home with him in the subway and asking him the difference between mathematics and physics. At that stage, all I knew, they were both fiddling with equations.
So what kind of age would that have been, by the way, roughly? Still high school.
That would have been probably, since he entered Stuyvesant, I believe, a year after me. He was younger than I was. That would probably be my second year at Stuyvesant.
Mm-hmm. Did you discuss things like logic and computing? I know computing was at a
very... Not in high school.
No, so he didn't.
But very much in college. He was really influenced by his studies under Emil Leon Post.
So Post was City College as well, right? Yes, John Stachel was...
As was Martin Davis.
Oh, was he not a student there? Was he was teaching.
Martin Davis and Jack were both students at the same time as me at City.
So, I mean, going back to high school, I mean, do you remember what topics were coming up in the courses? What subjects you were studying?
The person I interacted most with somehow was the chemistry professor Lieberman. And I would not be a bit surprised if it's the same Lieberman that Feynman mentions, but his was out in Long Island and mine was on Manhattan Island. But people move. They were both chemistry professors.
Was it?
Chemistry teachers, I mean.
But it was a man. It wasn't Hugh Lieberman, was it?
Pardon?
Hugh. H-U-G-H.
there was a Hughes at City College, who was a pretty important, he was my mentor in an honors course, and I believe he wrote a book with Zemanski.
Mm.
And I think he was quite smart. He taught a course in mathematical physics at the City.
So when you were at high school, did you know that you were going to go to college and do physics, or were you... So what was the...
I was already reading... one of my folk heroes, I guess, is Gabriel Crohn. Do you know the name at all?
He's the computer guy, right?
No. He was an electrical engineer with mathematical and generalist inclination.
Oh, it's the guy who travelled around the world after...
No, his specialty was applying tensor analysis to electrical networks and rotating electrical machinery. And he wrote a few books on the subject, which actually involved differential geometry, or equations at least, more general than those of general relativity. His colleagues laughed at him for calling it tensor analysis, because they're all used to matrix algebra for the purposes of networks. And so he appealed to Beinisch Hoffman, mm-hmm, to verify that he was really doing tensor analysis using transformation theory. And
it's not a bit like Roger Penrose did later, is it? Penrose had some kind of notation.
Oh, it's a very different order of magnitude. Yeah. Crohn had great aspirations, but his mathematics was very limited.
It's Crohn as in
K-R-O-N, right.
I know the name.
And Penrose is a really gifted mathematician.
So when did you stumble across...
Last year at City, I think. Okay. Yeah, actually, it was indirect. There was a branch of Barnes & Noble near Stuyvesant High School. And wandering through it, I saw a couple of books by Dougherty and Keller, The Mathematics of Modern Engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, they describe Crohn's method.
Yeah, because I thought Crohn didn't have a university position. I thought he was
independent.
Yeah.
No, he didn't. He was an engineer at General Electric.
Ah, yeah, that is the same guy. Yeah, I know them. Did you stumble across these books by the Liebers?
Oh, they were delightful, yes. I enjoyed them very much. The mathematics, mm-hmm, was just at the level I could enjoy. And I'm sorry, they're out of print.
Some of them are back in print,
that's
actually.
Good news.
Yeah, the Relativity One and
Excellent.
Infinity. So when did you stumble across those? Do you remember?
At
high school. Yeah. Same as Stanley Daser mentioned those as well, as being sort of influential.
Right.
Did you know
books
she
was scarcer back then?
Yeah. You know, she went to Robertson to proofread that book. So it has good pedigree.
No, I didn't know that. Thank you.
I found some files that went through the Robertson archives. I don't suppose you were aware of her institute. Lillian Lieber had an institute called the Galois Institute.
I saw that mentioned in her book. It rang no bells at all. I never came across it again.
Yeah, it's very hard to find information on them, actually, which is strange.
Lovely title.
Then,
as I approached graduation, I went to the head of the physics department there, a man named Alexander Efron, and told them I liked physics and mathematics, what should I do for a living?
Mm.
And I gather that he graduated in physics in the middle of the Depression and was never able to find a physics job and ended up teaching high school. And he urged me not to go into physics. He said if I like physics and mathematics, I should be an electrical engineer.
Mm.
So I enrolled at City in electrical engineering. And really it was there that I discovered there was such a thing as a profession of physicist. And at the end of my first year, I took my courage and switched.
What did your parents think of the career.
They were very permissive. They thought I was going to be a doctor. They that's why I took Latin in high school.
How were you funded as an undergraduate?
I lived at home, and my parents supported me. City College was a subway college. I lived in Harlem.
So you mentioned that Martin Davis and Schwartz were there again, and they were drifting into... Were they studying mathematics, both mathematics? I'm wondering if you got any of the influence of the logic and these
intense,
kinds of things.
Intense, really. They would lecture me on Gödel's theorem until I began to understand what was going on. Mm-hmm. And Post had them programming computers before they existed.
Ah,
in order to carry out his program in decidability and computable functions.
What computers were they?
All paper. Conceptual.
Right. Yeah.
You don't have to have a computer to program them.
Excellent.
But they were doing recursive function theory.
As undergraduates?
I mean, if for example, they would program a Turing machine, which is completely conceptual. Right.
Yeah.
And I know that influenced me.
So when did you switch to physics? Physics or maths?
I switched from engineering to physics.
To physics,
in my first year at City.
You didn't get tempted by maths?
Tempted, but there was not significantly tempted.
Okay.
I was too much in love with physics.
So, what kind of discussions were you having at the time? John Stachel was there. Were you friends with John Stachel?
And yes. As much as I was a friend with anyone, Stachel was certainly in my group.
Do you remember anything about the... Because obviously the communist paranoia started then. His dad must have been indicted round about the time he started.
Right, and I didn't get involved in it, but I knew it was going on.
Hmm. I don't suppose you have notebooks and stuff from that,
from undergraduate
college,
days? No. From graduate school, maybe.
So Stachel mentioned that the head of physics at City College wasn't very nice. He didn't like him. Do you remember anything along those lines? He didn't give me a name. Because he ended up leaving, right?
I made a mistake in names. When I spoke of Hughes, when you mentioned Hughes, and I switched to Hughes. The best theoretical physicist at City College at the time was Professor Wolff. I don't know why I call him Hughes.
So who else was teaching in physics at that time in City College?
The ones I remember were Wolff and Zemanski, and it would take me a while to dredge up other names.
I
took an electronics laboratory, but I forget the name. A lonely man, but I forget his name.
And
they even had a course in AC machinery, electrical lab. I probably took that.
So you started just as the war finished. Did you notice the effects of that again? Do you remember anything about the effects on the courses, on what kind of physics was done, on the teachers?
I'm sure there were. I'm not sure they were strong. Actually, they may have been. No, I didn't. I didn't know what was going on.
Do you have any recollection about what kind of physics you wanted to do whilst you were an undergraduate?
That was really determined for me in my first year at City. Namely, I knew that one had to know quantum theory to do physics. And I found there weren't that many books on quantum theory then. And I found them incredibly opaque.
Do you remember which ones you were reading?
Well, I looked at Aaron Walter Kimball, and I looked at Pauling, and I found them impossible to read. The break from mechanics and electrodynamics was just too much to follow. The mathematics was not the problem. The problem was the disconnection from the mechanical way of doing physics.
Mm.
And I really was in despair. I went into a fairly grave depression. And it was just an incredible stroke of luck. Well, also I spent some time searching, but I came across a paper by Birkhoff and von Neumann, The Logic of Quantum Mechanics. And actually, all the basic ideas in that paper are already in von Neumann's book on quantum mechanics, but I didn't know that at the time. I thought this was the beginning. And von Neumann made it very clear and convincing that quantum theory was a change in logic corresponding to that of the change in geometry in general relativity. And within a day or two, I realized that if one changes the logic, then one must reconstruct the whole set theory, which is founded on that logic. And I really had some electricity in my spine at being in on the bottom of that ladder.
So, do you think your interactions with Davis and Schwartz sort of helped prepare you for taking that on board?
Really.
Did you discuss the von Neumann paper with those? Or with anybody else?
I probably tried to, because it was what I was thinking of all the time.
Mm.
But I never found anyone who was responsive.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what the aftermath of that paper was. I don't think it got heavily cited, really, did it?
I think it is now.
It is now, yeah, because of the idea that logic is an empirical thing. It's, but yeah, at the time.
Actually, there's nothing really new conceptually beyond what Heisenberg said. What Phenomenon was doing was axiomatizing Heisenberg's statements.
Mm.
Heisenberg already understood that filtrations don't commute in quantum theory, and they do in classical physics. It's just that von Neumann had rather recently finished his thesis in which he invented a new set theory, functional set theory. Mm. So he was alert to re-axiomatizations.
Were you not tempted to go and try and study with either of these, von Neumann or Birkhoff?
I must say that never occurred to me.
Did you ever meet von Neumann later on?
I chauffeured him. When I was a graduate student at MIT, he came to town to give an address to the American Mathematical Society at Harvard. And I was a graduate student they entrusted with getting him from Tech Square to Kendall Square.
I didn't
have the courage to say a word.
That's very good.
But, by the way, his talk was one, he was asked to update Hilbert's problems. What were the outstanding problems of mathematics today? And he really only gave one, exploring quantum mathematics, the consequences of quantum
mechanics. I take it you went and saw the lecture?
I was at that lecture, yes.
Yeah. Did you ask a question?
No.
So why did you...
And as looking back from my present understanding, I was incredibly naive in those days, and I realized that von Neumann was too, in that he dropped the operational foundations that Heisenberg had and really concentrated on axiomatizing one aspect of Heisenberg's work, So it's influenced more by his own background, and I would say a belief in matter waves, than by the philosophy of Heisenberg and Bohr. But he was quite clear that the old logic was gone and the new one worked.
You mean the focus on observables?
Yeah, he didn't talk about observables. Mm. I don't think there's a description of an experiment.
No, that's true, actually.
It gave an opportunity to use Hilbert space.
Yeah.
There's this famous paper by Wigner on the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. And then there's this response by Jack Schwartz, the pernicious influence of mathematics in the natural sciences. And this book by Frenoyman is an example of both.
Yeah, I know those papers well. did you study, who was teaching quantum mechanics at City College?
I took an honors course with Wolf.
Okay. Was the...
I took one with Wolf and one with Zemanski.
How do you spell Zemanski?
Zemansky.
Yeah.
And with Zemanski, I read this very, very fat book on quantum statistical mechanics. I'm blocking the name because I haven't looked at it in 50 years or longer. Tolman.
Oh, yeah.
Tolman's book.
Okay. I assume you didn't do any general relativity. Was there any general relativity being taught at all?
No, but I read Einstein's books. Most of what... In my early years at Stuyvesant, at Stevens, thanks to the generosity of Peter Bergman, I went to a conference in France at L'Abbaye de Royaumont, not far from Paris. And that was my first conference in general relativity.
When was that? That must have been 58, 59 though, right?
Right. Quite early. And I'm trying to remember what I was doing there.
Did you give a talk? Did you give a paper?
I think so, yes. It was 59. No, I don't think I had done the little work I did on the black hole by the time of that meeting.
Well, it must have been an early meeting, I think. So you, because I think
I'm not sure what I talked about. Anyway, brought me to that. Oh yes, I went to. This was my first introduction to a group of relativists. I went around asking people of my age why they took up relativity, and without exception, all of them gave the same reason I did. Eddington's book, The Mathematical Principle of General Relativity.
Okay, I was going to mention Eddington because I can. There are a few. When did you read that? That book, Eddington's book. Did you read Eddington's book?
Must have been City College.
So did you have a go at any of other Eddington's?
Oh, I read it from cover to cover, yeah.
Did you read any of his other books?
I went to his other books also. I tried to read Fundamental Theory.
Yeah, Deyser says the same thing. He tried to read Fundamental Theory. Yeah. Did you try again later on in life to read that book?
Well, today I have a little more... It's not just that I don't understand it. I see him making important mistakes.
Hmm.
But they're deep mistakes. It's not mathematical errors.
Did you learn from Eddington's book with anybody, or is this just on your own?
So, yeah.
But you think when? At City College or MIT or later?
Oh, it certainly wasn't MIT. It must have been City, yes.
Okay. Did you do any choose any mathematics courses to go to help you learn this kind of the material?
The mathematics course, first of all, Feshbach gave a course in mathematical physics using a mimeograph version of what later became his book, Morse and Feshbach.
That was at MIT though, right? Not at City College, yeah.
And at City College, They were not, I can't remember taking any important math courses that weren't required.
Was it, Rarita wasn't at City College,
pardon?
Was he? Rarita.
Didn't meet him, no.
Was he there though?
I think he was ahead of me, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at MIT, I took a couple of math courses that were important for me. One was under Walter Harry Pitts.
Yeah, I was going to mention.
And he taught a course out of Stone, functional analysis,
mm-hmm.
which is basically a course in Hilbert space algebra.
That's not Pitts, as in McCulloch and Pitts.
It is exactly
that
one. Pitts. Right. We were very good friends, to the extent that either of us were able to have friends at MIT. We went for walks along the beach.
Mm-hmm.
I remember picking up clams from the sand and eating them. And this really struck me as odd at the time. But of course, the same clam that you get in the fish market, so why not?
Yeah.
And he introduced me to McCulloch.
So they'd done the... Because I didn't think he...
I spoke to him of my interest in general relativity. And he said, but that's merely special relativity made local.
I don't... What was Pitts' background? Because I always think of him as the McCulloch and Pitts person and the nervous system stuff. But he was a mathematician or a mathematical physicist.
He was a protege of Wiener.
Right.
And he was a real genius, self-taught. His father worked in a boiler factory, making boilers. And I think Pitts did too for a while. And it's a tragic story. He learned enough chemistry to make his own drugs and destroyed his brain.
Huh.
Quite a few years later, when I was at Stevens, I made a pilgrimage to... I realized how important my acquaintance with him had been. And I made a pilgrimage to Cambridge to say thank you.
Hmm.
And I found him finally, and he was sitting reading in the bar at Cambridge Square, in Harvard Square, and he didn't remember me, and he wasn't really able to carry on a conversation, wasn't interested in carrying on a conversation.
Hmm.
So the Pitts I knew was gone.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much longer he lived after that.
I read a book about Norbert Wiener, a biography of Norbert Wiener, and apparently there was some issue between him and McCulloch, I think, which led on to Pitts getting depressed. I don't know, maybe I'm remembering wrong. Did you remember anything about that interaction? Were you there when Wiener and McCulloch and Pitts were all there?
Yes,
at MIT?
Certainly. Absolutely, yeah. And I wasn't involved in their interaction.
So, I mean, going back to City College, when did you do a bachelor's thesis while you were there, and what was that on?
Right. Our teacher was a delightful man. Jack and I took a honors course together over the summer, and we had to produce a thesis. His name will come to me in a moment. He was a little odd, and they had an infinite number of children. And he'd furnish his room with stacks of cots.
Yeah, that would make you a bit odd.
And they ran him ragged. There was nothing like parental discipline or... the name is on the tip of my tongue. I haven't uttered it in decades.
Do you remember what he taught?
And Jack's honors thesis was on vector spaces with a transfinite number of dimensions beyond Hilbert space.
Mm-hmm.
which has a countable number of dimensions.
Still okay. Yeah, sorry. No.
And we had read André Weil's book together during that summer in our intensive way, and I wrote a book on a thesis on alternatives to Weil's concept of an algebraic geometry.
Weil, when you say Weil?
André Weil.
Oh, as in W-E-I-L. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And it was in that study that I learned the importance of algebras being regular.
So you'd been doing algebraic geometry tools while still an undergraduate?
I guess so, yes, right. And that turned out to be very useful in reading quantum logic. Because of the algebraic, the use of algebra in setting up coordinates for quantum logics.
Mm-hmm. Did any of that go into your thesis, or was it a separate?
There was no mention of quantum logic in my thesis.
Right.
It was pure algebraic geometry.
But did you have it in mind back then? No, I hadn't.
I didn't realize how useful it would be.
Okay, so when did you decide on MIT, or did you apply various places, or was MIT the only place?
I probably applied to a few places. I know I applied to Princeton.
Mm-hmm. Did you have
a quota?
Yeah. Did you have anybody in mind at Princeton, or just?
Not really. I knew what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I guess you could call it quantum gravity. But they needed someone to do computation in the astronomy department,
mm-hmm.
and they hired one of my best friends, also going back to Stuyvesant High School and then City, Irving Rabinowitz, and that filled their quota for New York Jews for that year.
Mm.
So I went to MIT, and I'm very grateful I did. At MIT, I was allowed into Weizkopf's evenings with his graduate students. An experience that I'll always cherish. Marvelous man. And he had an attitude to quantum theory related to that at Princeton, like the difference between Heisenberg and Wigner. So I learned it almost from the horse's mouth, and I'm very grateful. At Princeton, they were worried about things like collapsing wave functions,
mm-hmm.
and multiple. But they were simply going around saying that nobody understands quantum theory. And the fact is, Heisenberg understood quantum theory, and Bohr came very close. The big problem was getting out from under the idea of matter waves. The ancestry of de Broglie, and Schrödinger never understood quantum theory.
Mm.
He wrote papers to prove it, like his famous Schrödinger cat paradox. Nowadays, computers have Schrödinger states, and they are as close to absolute zero as they can get them. So for a cat to have a wave function, you have to have a beam of cryogenic cats, so cold that you can do interference experiments with it.
Yeah.
And then the question of whether the cat is alive, it's kind of silly.
Yeah. I think Anton Zeilinger once said he wants to quantum interference, put himself through a quantum interference device one day.
Right.
Did you begin with a master's degree at MIT, or was it straight into...
At MIT, the master's was given en passant.
Right.
If you decided to stay in for a doctorate, they gave you a master's anyway.
Yeah. And Weizkopf was your supervisor?
No.
Or was that
he was my supervisor until Villars came. I got there a year before Felix Villars.
How do you spell that?
V-I-L-L.
Oh, yeah. As in Pauli.
And he came from working with Pauli.
Yeah.
There was a little family incest there. Pauli, Weizkopf, Villars.
Yeah. Feshbach was there as well, though, right? And he was... Was he there? Feshbach?
Did you say brother?
No, he was there
at
the same time, and he was doing similar...
In fact, I did a problem under him. I never took a course in quantum theory. So... and I got there when no course was being offered, because I came in the middle of the term. Mm. I had graduated a little early from high school, from City College. Mm. So Weissach just gave me the book on quantum theory of... it was the standard book at the time. Schiff. And told me to do every problem. So I handed in the problems, and that was my education, quantum theory.
Is that...
I've never taken a course in quantum theory.
Is it Leonard Schiff? What's his name?
Leonard Schiff, yeah. It is.
That was the standard MIT textbook, was it? That everybody did.
Right. And it's one of the best, I still think.
Okay. Did you do any quantum field theory? Or was that from the Schiff book? Does Schiff go into quantum field theory? I forget.
A little bit at the end, yes.
So was your thesis topic set by your supervisor?
Yes.
Or were you also working on separate projects as well at the same time?
Well, I tried to educate myself. I must say that the period when I was doing my thesis, it's one of the more unpleasant times in my life. I didn't want to work on nuclear forces. But that the nonlinear theory of nuclear forces was as close as they came to the nonlinear theory of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And quantum in both cases. So that was the best they could do for me. But I slept 15 hours a day or something like that.
So when you were given this project, was there some conscious decision to have it connected to general relativity?
Oh, yes. That was as close as they could come.
So why at this stage did you want to do general relativity? Where did that
come from? Well, this is part of the original epiphany. Namely, if changes in geometry show themselves up as fundamental forces,
mm-hmm.
then chances are changes in logic might take place from place to place and show up as the other forces.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had the idea of paralleling Einstein's work in a quantum logical syntax. And that actually is consistent with the gauge program. I didn't quite understand that at the time, but I felt that what I was doing was building on general relativity, with quantum, adding quantum, trying to move the structure from its classical foundations to quantum ones without destroying it.
Hmm. So you were trying to solve the problem of quantum gravity, really?
I wasn't interested in quantizing gravity.
Yeah.
I was interested in quantizing the universe. Gravity is just one part of it.
Oh, so you're trying to get just some kind of unified theory based on logic?
I think I was looking for a unified theory. To me, that is no longer the right thing to do, to trap.
Hmm.
But I was pretty deep in the trap.
So you didn't have any girdle kind of problems with unified theories of everything at the time, or anything?
I think it's a archaic notion. I trace it back to the logos of Parmenides, but I was buried and I was floating in it.
So who were you talking to about that side of your work while you were at MIT? Because there were plenty of people who were sort of interested in similar things. So, I mean, Norbert Wiener, I've just been in MIT and I was looking at the Wiener archives.
Wiener was a problem. He, what was his attitude? He had his own quantum theory. He deeply resented Heisenberg's success in solving a problem that Wiener couldn't handle. What was it again? He would bother Weisskopf with his ideas for hours, and finally, in desperation, they decided to throw him a graduate student. And they offered me the position, but going back to classical physics, which is what Wiener was trying to do, was the last thing I wanted to do. And they offered it then to another graduate student who collaborated with Wiener.
Was that the differential space guy? The differential space?
It could be, yes.
I forget the guy's name.
In a moment I'll probably get the name of the student. But it never came close to quantum theory. It was working on... Differential space sounds right.
I forget the student. I know which one you mean.
And
I can find out.
Joint paper on this idea.
Yeah.
And never got anywhere.
Yeah, I can find that out. But I actually found a paper from 1951 in the Norbert Wiener archives where he was trying to come up with a unified theory of physics based on Eddington-type ideas, on the observer, the centrality of the observer. Do you not
remember? Eddington at least had non-commutative variables in his work. I mean, he got the essence of quantum theory, and Wiener never was willing to take that path.
Mm. So it was, I'm trying to think who else was there, who would have been relevant. So who else were you speaking to, if not Wiener?
My office mate was Kirsten Huang.
Oh, yeah.
And we became pretty good friends. I'm sorry that life has separated us.
Was Gabor in at MIT?
Gabor, I never met him, as far as I know.
Because he was working on this
holography,
right, and the logon stuff, and there's vague similarities to trying to get some kind of sort of quantum of information idea. You don't remember any talks on that? Were there seminars, general, regular physics seminars?
Right, there were a couple. There was a little seminar where graduate students were given an opportunity to exercise their ability before faculty.
Mm.
I gave a talk there on the nonlinear meson, on the... Tamanaga theory of bosonic excitations in a fermionic gas. And I realize now that my recent work is actually relevant to the problem of how do you make bosons out of fermions.
Mm-hmm.
And you could think of it, of Tamanaga's work as a limiting case.
So your thesis was on the nonlinear meson theory.
Yeah. Essentially, a theory proposed by Keller first, I think.
So it's not Yukawa's theory that you were looking at, or anything?
It presupposes Yukawa's theory.
Right.
But Yukawa proposed a linear meson theory. The nonlinearity was the interaction between the meson and the nucleon. And the free meson was linear.
Hmm.
And Teller added what amounts to a repulsive force of meson to meson to account for the saturation of nuclear forces.
So had the cosmic ray stuff happened by then?
Oh, yes.
Is this why it was being pursued? So...
I didn't know about the connection.
Oh. So you were at MIT until 1953.
Right.
Okay. So in obviously we get the Korean War during that. Again, was there any impact of the Korean War on you?
No. During that? By then I was married and my wife was pregnant. I was at Stevens. And we both decided that I shouldn't leave her. So I took advantage of draft deferment that was available.
So did you do any war work? Were you sort of expected to work on...
Yes. And for a while I actually transferred from Stevens to NYU and worked at the AEC computing facility. I was studying radiation effects in the upper atmosphere.
So I have that you did some work. I mean, I think this photo, the photo I've got at the front, is from when you were working on...
That lab work at Yeshiva University.
Is it?
That comes a bit later in the story.
Okay.
But what happened is, as a result of my work at... What later became the Courant Institute at the AEC computing facility. Yes, I was even hired to work for Project Sherwood.
Right.
That's the name associated with the Los Alamos group, but I guess somehow the NYU group fitted under that rubric, while at Princeton it...
Matterhorn.
It went under another name.
Do you mean the other project?
I'm trying to remember the name of the Princeton Plasma Lab.
Yeah, Matterhorn.
Matterhorn, yes.
Lyman Spitzer's.
Exactly. Spitzer, Matterhorn. Jim Tuck, Sherwood Forest.
Yeah, yeah. But maybe come back to that. But you,
I probably said Spitzer. I meant to say Spitzer.
Yeah. Because I have that you were doing some computing work in 1953 at MIT on Project Whirlwind.
Yeah, right. That was my thesis. Actually, it was two steps. First, I had a nonlinear meson theory. I had to solve the radio equation. Mm-hmm. So I needed a computer to put it on. First I put it on Vannevar Bush's differential analyzer. And it kept going off scale before I got to the origin. Or anywhere near it. I thought this might be a computational fault. So I switched to Whirlwind.
Mm.
And ran the computer there, ran the program there, and again, never got close. I could not approach the origin. I expected to find some function like the Yukawa potential or the Coulomb potential, all of them are defined on the whole real axis. But I couldn't get below a certain point. And finally, a good high school friend, Donnie Newman, sort of took me aside and told me the facts of life about nonlinear differential equations and wandering singularities. Mm-hmm. And so the radial equation for the Schiff nonlinear meson, which has a phi-fourth term after the phi-squared term with a plus sign, the radial equation for that blows up before you get to the origin, mm-hmm, at a point which depends on the amplitude of infinity. That was my first encounter with the wandering singularity. And I met it again in plasma physics, and I met it again in the black hole.
Mm-hmm.
And every time it came as a surprise.
How were you able to get on projects on the computer? Was it just available? Did you have to sign a thing saying, I would like to use the computer for this long? Or?
I think there was no difficulty. I simply walked in and asked, could I run this?
How did you know how to write the programs for it in those days? Who taught you that?
Well,
I don't remember. They probably just gave me the manual. I'd already been programming on Turing machines and so on, thanks to Post.
Imaginary Turing machines.
Right. Oh, also, while I was in high school, I tried to build a Logic digital computer in a garage. And we had no... It was me and Virgil Johannes, who later became the head of the electrical engineering department at a school in New Jersey. And it involved rectifiers, and I tried making them out of copper oxide, out of copper dipped in acid, and I couldn't get good enough coatings. Never got off the ground. But anyway, it relieved a childhood itch to actually be near a computer that worked.
Yeah, it's very good. I mean, do you...
It'll go away. They always stop.
Do you think getting your hands on computing equipment had any sort of influence on the type of logical work that you did and then later on? You know, Bryce DeWitt worked on the computers. Well, he was on Project Sherwood, wasn't he? He did the Lagrangian hydrodynamics stuff, detonation hydrodynamics.
Right.
And you can sort of trace lines from that work into his quantum gravity work. Do you think there's anything traceable from the computing side in your case?
I don't know. I'm not conscious of a strong connection. But I've always felt at home with computers. Mm. Because of this early study with friends who worked under Post.
Yeah. So it looks like you wrote a software package with somebody called Gill and Rottenberg, called SADSAC. So do you remember that? And how did that come about?
It just happened that after I finished my thesis work, there was a crash program to produce a package that could be used by executives of industry and finance who wanted to explore the use of computers in industry and business. And Whirlwind had a totally unfriendly language. So we had... And Fortran didn't exist yet. Mm. So we put together a single address simulated automatic computer that was much friendlier than the assembly language, machine language, had instructions that a business user could use, and gave an automatic postmortem whenever there was a crash.
It debugged itself, basically. Was that the first one to do that? Was it the first example?
I would not be surprised. I've never checked. Huh. And Stanley Gill was over from England. He had worked with Wilkes.
Oh, yeah. Maurice Wilkes. So who came up with the name? Sad
stuff. I probably did. I like names.
Yeah.
The thing is that while Whirlwind ran like the wind, we so slowed it down with our post-mortem facilities. Yeah.
The early version of Windows.
It was run interpretively, so you could actually hear the computer doing instructions one at a time.
Did you meet Jay Forrester or anything? Was he so he wasn't in charge or anything?
But I saw a room full of Forrester tubes, not long before they disappeared, and were replaced by one little box of
those little magnetic loops.
Of loops, right? Yeah. That was impressive.
Did you try and search anything out about people working on applying computers to physics? Because Conrad Suze, when was he doing his... Oh, no, that was much later, I suppose. Conrad Suze. Okay, so okay, 53, and then you went to Stevens in 53, or did you go to Stevens earlier, and then there was some back and forth?
No, back and forth. The only back and forth was with NYU.
Right. So remind me what the NYU...
I moved from Stevens to NYU, and then I moved back.
In 53, or later?
I probably spent about a year at NYU. In that time, I visited the Livermore Radiation Lab and worked there with Winston Harry Bostick.
Right. Okay, so Bostick was he was head of Stevens, wasn't he, later?
Not was. First I met him at
Livermore,
and then when I returned to Stevens, I suggested him as head of the department, and he accepted.
Okay. So was Bryce DeWitt at Livermore at the time?
Who?
Bryce DeWitt.
I have no idea. I didn't realize he was associated with Livermore.
Yeah. So
I don't think I met him there. I would remember that.
Yeah. I think. Yeah, maybe he'd left by then. So who else was at Livermore? How long did you go to?
It was the summer.
Was it just Bostick who you hung around with?
I interacted with Bostick more than anyone.
Did you start to discuss general relativity things with Bostick? Because he had an interest, right?
He was an interesting man, but he was not a mathematician at all. Even his plasma physics was pretty much intuitive. He visualized magnetic lines of force.
Because I think...
He did end up with a unified theory. He thought that everything was a magnetoplasma.
Yeah, because he had there's a paper of his in the Gravity Research Foundation essay composition thing from 1958, where he had a theory of the stabilization of elementary particles by gravitational forces, which I assume sounds plasma-ish. And yeah, so that's where that comes from. So who did you suggest Bostick as head to?
I guess to the administration.
Who was head before that? Did it have a head, or was it running with
what happened to the previous head? I don't remember.
So how did you get hired at Stevens?
How did I get hired? Through a friend. George Yevick had gotten his degree at MIT and gone to Stevens, and Velarez knew him quite well and recommended me to Yevick.
Can you spell Yevick?
Y-E-V-I-C-K. And we became good friends. He's deceased now.
So did you receive any other invitations from other places?
Excuse me?
Any other invitations for jobs or anything?
No. No, I get perhaps because my work wasn't that great, or I'm isolated or something, but I had to pretty much make my own way. The thing is, I hadn't worked on the real problem of any member of the faculty.
Mm.
And so they couldn't recommend me to their colleagues.
Yeah.
There wasn't a quantum gravity community. I consider myself very fortunate to get a teaching job which allowed me enough time to think.
Yeah, well, and it was lucky that it was at Stevens, obviously, because it became the relativity hub. Maybe.
Well, that came after my going there, of course.
Mm.
I invited Schiller and
Anderson.
I don't think I had anything to do with Anderson's coming.
Okay.
I don't remember his connection. But maybe he came because of Schiller.
Mm.
He certainly, Schiller was already doing relativity because of Bergman. He had his credentials. And Anderson, I don't know who he worked for, but he was already a relativist.
Oh, well, yeah, he was at Syracuse as well.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, so he was under Bergman.
Excellent. Yeah. So that became a little offshoot of Bergman's of Syracuse, and that they are responsible for the meetings.
Mm.
I was just fortunate enough to be around.
Let's see, so what was your initial research program? Do you remember when you started at Stevens? What was the thing that you were interested in at the time?
I felt I had to do an apprenticeship before I tackled the real problem. And I certainly wouldn't do classical field theory. But Einstein talked as if a theory like general relativity, like gravity, might have all the elementary particles in it, if you look carefully. And to the quantum mechanic, this raises immediately the question of spin a half. How do you get spin a half out of gravitons, which have spin two?
Mm-hmm.
But here, my reading of Wigner was crucial. Wigner gave a topological theory of which systems could have spin a half. Not really. He explained the spin a half of the electron as a result of the double connectedness of the rotation group. Because of that, I took a course under Borevich at MIT on topology and learned about the higher homotopy groups from the man who invented them.
Who?
Borevich, Vitold.
Oh yeah, H.U. Hurwitz, I always pronounced it.
Right.
Okay.
H-U-R-E-W-I-C-Z.
Yeah. Oh wow.
He was a very dear man.
Hmm.
And I realized that in order for the gravitational field to have spin a half, you have to figure out how the rotation group acts on it, and then see if the orbits of the rotation group can be shrunk to a point or not. There are only two kinds, those which can and those which can't. And if they can, then it doesn't have spin a half. And if they can't, then in principle it could have spin a half, even though that might get lost in a perturbation theory calculation.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally, the theory is nonlinear, so the topology could be non-trivial. You have to do the calculation of the homotopy group. I think this was probably the first application of higher homotopy to physics. Nowadays, they speak of moduli spaces.
So when are we talking here? Is this when you first started at Stevens? Or earlier when you were doing...
So I started Stevens in 53.
And you were immediately working on that idea?
Right.
Getting spin half.
Yeah, and fortunately I met Misner at these relativity meetings. And he was at Princeton, which was a hotbed of homotopy theory.
Mm-hmm.
And he had studied it there. He used homology theory intensively in his work on electromagnetism and gravitational fields, in his formulation of the theory, and in general relativity too. But he knew homotopy theory as if he had worked in it. And so I went to him with my problem. And this is one of the thrilling moments in my life. He just turned around and pulled Steenrod's theory of fiber bundles off the shelf, and in a few moments converted my question about the homotopy of the gravitational field to a question about the homotopy of manifolds of subspaces. Nowadays there's a name. No, there already was a name in Steenrod. lucky on it. Anyway, the problem was reduced from finding the first homotopy group, the fundamental group of a field, to finding the fourth homotopy group of a of finite dimensional manifold, mainly of light cones in Minkowski space-time. Mm-hmm. This is based on the fact that for topological purposes, the gravitational field is just a field of light cones. And the answer came out two. That there was, you had to go around twice.
Yeah,
there were two elements to the homotopy group. It was non-trivial. And that meant that the gravitational field could have spin a half, even if Einstein thought so. And for a moment I was tempted to start studying the gravitational field, but of course that assumes classical space-time. And I knew that one had to get to quantum space-time to carry out the program. So I resisted the temptation.
How did you know?
But that led to the black hole.
I'll come to that in a second. How did you know about Misner?
We met at the Stevens meetings.
So when did they start, the Stevens meetings?
Shortly after I arrived.
Really? They've been going that long? I thought the relative... Was this the general seminars?
Yeah. No. Because then general. It wasn't a Stevens seminar. It was organized by Anderson and Schiller.
So they go way back.
I'd probably been there a couple of years at the time, but...
I have the first one starting in 1958, but you think they were way before then? I mean, there was...
It's possible. From this distance, time telescopes. There weren't... It's true, I didn't go to that many. Well, you're probably right. And that's consistent with when I published on the black hole and so on. It was all within a couple of years of that.
So let me see if I can find it. I have you giving a talk at the Stevens meetings on...
It's probably just I've been thinking about these things for longer.
So in 19...
But I certainly met Misner at those meetings.
So in 1957, November 19th, 1957, there's you giving spin without spin. Maybe that's something different, an ordinary unified theory simplified by spinners.
I think I did, yes, as rehearsal for the spin of gravity, I looked at other classical models for spin a half. I asked what kinds of bodies could, by their rotation, have spin a half. Mm-hmm. That was another warm-up exercise.
Ah, yeah, so because your first paper in 1955 was on the internal structure of spinning particles.
I asked what kind of particles acted on by the Lorentz group. Particles not in the modern sense, but in the sense of structures. Mm. What invariant objects could have spin a half. For example, a sphere can't, because it doesn't have enough markers. Rotation of a sphere is trivial. And a tetrahedron, or the relativistic analog, a pentahedron, mm-hmm. could, by if you mark the vertices, so you can tell that it's turned around. I came up with a handful, or a small handful, of theories that can have spin a half. For example, in a field described by a null electromagnetic field, E plus IB, the field of a light wave. Mm-hmm. If you just imagine an object with that attached to it, it could have spin a half. They're orthogonal if it's a null vector.
So where do you think that...
And of course, if you apply tensor analysis, the usual, if you just look at the indices, you wouldn't think it could have spin a half. So it was encouraging.
Actually, I have that you did a paper called On Relations Between Commutators.
That's different. That grew out of my work in my interest in quantum logic.
Right. So the past...
I felt everything had to be done non-commutative. And the first thing you learn is calculus. So you need a non-commutative calculus. And the core of that was provided by H.S. Green, who at that time, I believe, was in Australia already. I pulled that out of his paper and expanded it into a proof of the well-known theorem about expanding the product of two exponentials as an exponential of the name of that theorem that I'm forgetting. It comes up again and again in the early parts of quantum field theory. E to the a times e to the b is e to the a plus b plus the half the commutator of a and b, and so on at the higher powers. Of course, the name is in the paper.
I can check that. Okay, so that was a kind of separate research project then.
No, it's all along the line of trying to quantize everything that moves, including the kitchen sink.
So the past-future asymmetry of the gravitational field paper. So that was 58.
That came out of the spin a half gravity.
Was that in your discussion with Misner, or was that a different paper than Misner?
I discovered the spin a half with Misner, definitely. And then I looked at the simplest model, the simplest gravitational field, whose rotation could do that. Mm. And it looked like this. Here are the light cones at infinity. And they tilt toward the origin like this, and then they meet there. If you have this happening in every radius, so it's spherically symmetric, then that generates the homotopy group of the gravitational fields. Every gravitational field is made of these and their antiparticles, their time reversals. And looking at it, it was clearly not symmetric under time reversal. You could see that because you could go in, but you couldn't get out. And that really scared me because there's this Birkhoff theorem, which says that if it's stationary and spherical at infinity, it's static. No difference between past and future. But that's a folk theorem. If you look carefully at Birkhoff's theorem, one way to say it is that if it's spherical and static at infinity, then it can be made spherical and stationary at infinity. It can be made static down to the first point where the time axis is a generator of the light cone. In other words, down to the horizon. So Birkhoff's theorem already says that if you look for a coordinate system that makes it static everywhere, it'll blow up at the horizon. And if you want to go through the horizon, you just have to go back to a coordinate system where the light cones are allowed to rotate. So we put in, that means a cross term in space and time. So we put in a variable one of the simplest kind and just adjusted it to eliminate the singularity of Schwarzschild. Took a few minutes. So that's a byproduct of the search for spin a half in gravity.
So it mentions you discussed that with Stachel and Anderson and Bruce Crabtree and Melvin Hausner as well. So they were they all at Stevens at the time?
Hausner was at NYU. Stachel was my graduate student at Stevens.
Yeah, he says.
Who else did you mention?
Bruce Crabtree.
Bruce Crabtree was on the faculty at Stevens.
Yeah, and Anderson as well.
And Anderson too.
So, actually, what was... I should have asked him. What was Stetzel working on? He was doing a master's thesis, wasn't he?
Right.
Was it a general relativity problem?
I'm trying to remember whether I inflicted quantum logic on him somehow. Or
he has a paper on quantum logic somewhere. So.
I don't think he liked it. No, he did like the idea of quantum logic. I'm sure he didn't write on it. No, it, for one thing, real Marxists think that quantum theory is idealistic and conflicts with the doctrines of Marx, namely the goal of physics is to control the universe, and if Heisenberg were right, there'd be limits to that control. And if you meet limits, you simply have to try harder. I don't know if they had the same problem with relativity and the speed of light. I think Stetzel has completely healed since then.
He seems to. Seems to have. Okay, so try and get the chronology right. So in 50, so Misner was working on this Rainich theory. Did you discuss the Rainich theory?
No, we didn't. Already I knew of his work on it.
So I'm just trying to work out when you must have met Misner, because I think it must have been.
It was certainly an important meeting for it. Let me think a moment.
So remember, Misner and Wheeler had this Annals of Physics paper on geometric dynamics in 55, but it would have been written in 54. And that had all the homology stuff in, and he was doing Betti numbers and all this kind of stuff. So maybe, would you have read that, do you think, when it came out?
I'm sure I read it, yeah.
And then I'm just wondering if there were already some sort of back and forth between Princeton and Stevens. Because Wheeler gets interested in relativity in about 53, right? Quite late.
I'm sorry?
John Wheeler started looking at relativity in about 1953.
Right.
And he was sort of travelling all over the place trying to find things out. So I'm just wondering if he went over to Stevens quite early on. And maybe took Misner with him, or something.
I don't remember him coming to Stevens except for the meeting, for the relativity meeting, but it could have escaped my memory.
Okay. So do you remember also Misner's Feynman quantization approach? Did you have any interest in?
Of course, that was. Did, I studied that very carefully. Read both Dirac's and Feynman's papers.
The way you look at that work is the idea to use the multiply connected space-time to get the right kind of particles out. Because I've often wondered why he was doing Feynman quantization.
Of course. When Feynman wrote, he built on classical space-time. Mm-hmm. And that meant that a lot of his mathematics were meaningless. You can't really do those integrals over the paths. Mm-hmm. I think of that more as a research program than a theory. And in fact, he discretized his space and time in order to get answers. And then went to the limit of the continuum of zero spacing. Mm. And I wanted to, I think space-time is built of atoms, quantum atoms, of course. I even named them in anticipation. So all the procedures of renormalization I consider it to be kind of irrelevant. Renormalization will survive as a physical process, just as you have the bias shielding in a plasma. That's a renormalization of charge, but it won't be infinite.
Since you had this, did you already have the discrete idea at Stevens then?
I don't think it was discrete ever. I think it was quantum,
right.
Which is neither discrete nor continuous. In terms of, I think in terms of the Hasse diagram or lattice diagram, and in classical physics, they're exactly as high as they are wide. If you have a coin flip, it's the diagram is a square,
mm-hmm.
empty, the false, the true, and the two heads and tails.
Mm-hmm.
So it's too wide and too high. And that's true for all of Boolean algebra. And then in quantum physics, you have too high, but instead of just two points, you have a whole circle. So it's
cone-shaped. Because you've got these extra superpositions, I suppose, here.
Right, you have all those superpositions. Yeah, so you have a point and a point, and then you have a continuous circle. So it's vertically discrete and horizontally continuous.
Okay.
So is that continuous or discrete?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm just trying to think in terms of looking at the path integral approach, whether you had any instinct
as far as I'm concerned, the path integral is just an operator product.
Yeah.
If you look at the product of several operators, A, B, C, D, and put the indices in, then one way of looking at that summation is a sum is as a sum over all the paths joining the indices. And I'm sure how the Feynman path emerges from a more quantum theory.
Mm.
Just an operator product.
Mm.
The important thing is that the thing you're multiplying is the exponential of a classical phase of a classical action.
Mm.
That Dirac saw an analogy and Feynman saw an exactness, but couldn't express it because of his commitment to the continuum. And I'm sure that that's going to survive.
But you'll have a different measure. Because I'm just wondering if you... there are elements of your work, especially when you get to the space-time code papers, that look very much like causal set theory. I'm just trying to figure out whether there was some causal set kind of things going on.
That was...
earlier.
What's the name again?
Danzig?
Causal sets?
Sorkin.
Raphael Sorkin. And I think I put him on to causal sets.
Okay.
In doing the homotopy analysis of gravity, I realized that what counted were the light cones, and they in turn just expressed the causal relation.
Mm.
So I defined the manifold by a causal relation. And Revolta Pimenov picked up on this in Russia and wrote a book about
Pimenov.
At the time, he was in a concentration camp. He was guilty of self-publication.
Mm.
And he was quite famous and got a high position when Stalin died and things liberalized. And he refers to my work on causal spaces very generously. I'd hoped to meet him sometime, but was never fortunate.
Did you know about Van Danzig's work on...
Number of the Language of Science?
Well,
I'm thinking of...
David Van Danzig, I think that's his name. He has this paper in the... do you know the 1955 Bern conference for Einstein? There was this paper by Van Danzig.
Which conference?
The Bern conference, the Jubilee of Relativity.
Oh, yes.
1955. There's a paper by Van Danzig where he has this kind of...
I'm not quite recognizing the name of the town as you say it.
Switzerland, Bern. B-E-R-N-E.
Oh. No, I see. No, I was thinking of a Warsaw conference.
Oh, Jablona. Yeah.
Jablona. And that okay, no, I wasn't at the conference you mentioned,
okay.
And I did. The name Van Danzig is kind of new to me.
Hmm. Okay.
Should I look at it?
Maybe. I can send you a copy.
Oh, please do. What kind of things did he do?
Well, almost came up with a similar idea to causal set theory, the idea that you model space-time by a discrete structure that has the properties.
The trouble with the theory of causal sets
partial
is that he's leaving quantization for the end.
Yeah.
He's building the theory classically. And it's true, every quantum theory has some kind of a classical skeleton. So it's okay, but then you shouldn't... Surely there must be some important physical effects that you discover only after the quantum theory is turned on.
Yeah. Actually, another person who springs to mind talking about that is von Weizsäcker.
I mean, if action means phase of the wave function, how can you possibly do dynamics on it before you talk about before you have wave functions with phases?
Mm-hmm. It's true. Did you have any knowledge of von Weizsäcker's?
Oh, we were very close.
Long ago, or when?
I remember our first meeting, I think. It was after, I think he was attracted by my work in quantum logic. Right. Yes. He too was struck by the fact that the Lorentz group is SL2, which is the group of a two-component complex vector, which means that it's a quantum logic.
Mm-hmm.
And because a two-component vector, it's the quantum theory of a binary choice. So this, both of us arrived at the idea that therefore space-time is a collection of binary decisions. And I think he did it before me. I'm sure he did. I guess he invited me to a conference. He had this annual series, Quantum Theories of Space and Time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I went to all of them, or all but one. And I was in his home often, and he in mine. And I visited him after he had Alzheimer's. And probably one of the last physicists to pay respects to him.
Mm.
We were brought together in some measure. Well, through him, I met Heinrich Soller.
What is Zoller, Soller?
Pardon?
How do you spell that name?
Saller. I guess it's Heinrich Soller, actually.
Okay. I don't know that name.
He was still alive and well. He retired from... Heisenberg, he worked with Heisenberg and retired from the Heisenberg Institute rather recently. But he now edits the journal I used to edit.
Okay, yeah, maybe get to that in a bit. So, back to Stevens and black holes.
Right.
Did Penrose visit Stevens before you? I take it you went to King's.
The first time I ever saw him was in London.
At King's College, was it?
Yeah. We were introduced by Dennis Sharma.
Yeah. Before that, did Felix Pirani visit you at Stevens? Because obviously Felix was at King's. I'm wondering if it was Felix that invited you back.
My offhand impression, the best I remember, is that I met him at King's.
Felix at King's as well. Right.
Not sure of that.
How did you get the invite to King's? Do you remember?
It wasn't especially King's for me. I had met Sharma at the meetings.
Ah, okay. So Sharma.
And he wanted me to meet Penrose, so he set it up, and it happened to be at King's.
So Sharma was at the Stevens meetings?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, how else could...
I suppose Bondi.
Let me think. No, I don't remember Sharma being at a Stevens meeting. We could have met at a relativity meeting.
So Pirani was at the Stevens meetings.
I know I had close conversations and friendly conversations with Sharma, but I think it was in Europe or England.
Oh, yeah, so you went to Roymore, you say, as well.
And then after I did my own black hole work, Sharma wanted me to meet Penrose, and it was at King's that I showed Roger the black hole, and he showed me the spin networks. And I was already trying to quantize space-time, but from the bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that one could just learn from spin something useful about space-time, the idea of building it from spins, I really learned from him.
Mm.
I'm not sure how long it would have taken me to have the courage to do that.
Yeah, he didn't.
So that was an important meeting for me.
So, I mean, did he have his manuscript, the Spin Network's manuscript, by then, or was it just ideas? Just
Oh, he may have had the manuscript. I'm sure he did. But he didn't call them Spin Networks, he called them MOPS.
MOPS?
Right.
Because they've got all the strands coming off them, the intertwining, whatever they are. He called them MOPS.
But there was an important exchange interaction. Namely, he walked away with a black hole and I walked away with spin networks.
Yeah,
and we'll probably meet again.
Yeah, he never really did anything beyond that with his spin networks, I suppose.
But it stimulated a lot of people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, he did. He made twisters.
That's true.
Except that twisters have a nonlinear. It means he already gave up quantum theory. But he doesn't understand quantum theory. He probably didn't realize he was giving it up.
So when you were in England, were you visiting King's as a research visitor? Or you were just passing through to give a talk?
I was there because I had a fellowship at CERN.
Ah,
I was stationed in Geneva for a year, on a sabbatical from Stevens.
Right, and the Roymore must have happened around then as well, so that's...
No, I think Roymore, I had it across the ocean. I think I came to Roymore from this country.
Okay.
And, yeah, I remember that.
All right, so CERN then. So why CERN?
At CERN...
Why did you go to CERN?
As a result of my work on plasmas at NYU, I became interested in Hüttger's idea of relativistic pinches. He thought of them not so much for thermonuclear application, but as guide fields for a table-size synchrotron.
Okay.
Table-sized cosmotron. If you have a current loop of relativistic particles traveling one way and antiparticles traveling the other way, so you have a relativistic current, a magnetic field is strong focusing at all points. Mm-hmm. You don't even have to have an alternating gradient. It just the pinch effect focuses anything you put in it. I call that a Budker accelerator, and I wanted to build one.
Mm.
Or at least take a step towards building one. And you have to begin by designing a field coil that will hold such a relativistic pinch in place. I have a patent on a single turn high field betatron, which I call the Megatron, because the field is about a megagauss. And I knew that the
accelerator group at CERN would have experts that could help me in that area. And the Ford Foundation funded me for a year at CERN. And it was there I met David Speiser, first of all, and
Yelk.
And Yelk, exactly, who was became interested in the quantum logic approach and wrote on it.
Yeah, I know his book, actually. I studied his book as a master's student, actually. So, I mean, so where did that project go? Did what happened to it?
Well, first, I'm afraid I didn't enjoy the mathematics of relativistic magnetohydrodynamics that much. And probably if I had tried to solve the problem theoretically, I'd still be working on it. So I decided to try and build one and see what happens. And that I did at Stevens with help from Bostick, who showed me how to put together vacuum systems and so on. And then it became clear that the circular machine was unstable. I didn't push it as hard as I could. It might be possible to stabilize it, but that would be yet another project on top of a project, lifelong pursuit. So anyway, that's what brought me to CERN.
You mentioned in...
Then at Yeshiva, I went straight. Namely, I thought a straight pinch would have a lesser stability problem. Namely, the whole thing only lasts for an instant. Maybe you can do what you want to do before it disappears.
Yeah.
And learn a little bit about relativistic pinches and use that for further work. So I built a linear machine, and that picture you saw was of my linear work at Yeshiva.
That's what that machine is, okay.
I put together a little capacitor bank and switching system.
Actually, you'll have to tell me what's it called, the exact?
The thing at the round one is called the Megatron.
What is the name
they were just control instruments
for
a relativistic linear pinch. Weakly relativistic, 1 MeV. My students assembled a capacitor bank at 100,000 volts and built a step up transformer to charge a water capacitor to 1,000,000 volts and then discharge that into the pinch.
Did you discuss any of this with Kruskal? He used to work on this, on plasmas and...
I think...
Did you have any...
Kruskal and I had two major overlaps. First, his work on solitons helped me think about the simplest example of a topologically non-trivial field, which also led to something like solitons. I called mine topological solitons to distinguish them from his, where the soliton was held together purely by dynamics. And so we had a sort of casual interaction because of the similarity of that work. The important thing is that after I found my regularization of the Schwarzschild singularity, at one of the plasma meetings, I showed it to him, and he immediately took out an envelope and sketched regularization of my solution. I had only half of the complete solution. And he had worked it out as a homework exercise in a general relativity course he had taken years ago and never thought it was worth publishing.
So that presumably was with Wheeler, right? He was with John Wheeler, wasn't he? Was he a grad student of Wheeler's?
No, not particularly, no. No, he was quite he was working for the plasma group for years.
So you
At the time he did his relativity homework, I have no idea who he was studying with.
Yeah, that's with him. Because I heard a story that the Kruskal paper with his diagrams.
That came later.
Right.
Namely, after I published my paper, and which footnotes Kruskal, and the Kruskal solution became known, he still wasn't publishing.
Mm.
And the way I hear it is that Wheeler finally wrote the paper and got Kruskal to sign it.
That's what I heard. Yeah. Okay, so you were in discussions with Kruskal when you were writing the Kinks paper. Is that right, or was it later?
Yes.
So Misner and Kruskal.
Right.
Okay. So you called your horizon a unidirectional membrane.
Right.
Do you remember who came up with the name horizon?
Horizon to me sounds like Penrose. I'm pretty sure he was the one who called it a horizon.
So do you remember giving this, the Schwarzschild solution paper at the Stevens meetings, rehearsing it there?
I imagine I did. It's funny, I actually don't remember doing that. I'm pretty sure I gave it at Royal Mont.
Hmm.
That I can check by looking at their volume.
So, I mean, what do you remember of the relativity seminars? I mean,
rather little, actually. Misner spoke on the problem of the dynamics of general relativity.
Mm.
And in particular, the huge number of constraints that come up in the theory. I remember later on, he gave a general colloquium at Princeton, and Oppenheimer was in the audience. And Misner pointed out that in general relativity, the Hamiltonian has to vanish identically, because changing time is just a change of coordinates. And Oppenheimer didn't get it. He asked some not terribly intelligent questions, and finally the thing had to go ahead.
Was that, I'd heard Dirac had a problem with that as well.
That was the main problem he solved, the problem of constraints. So.
Oh no, but I'm thinking of the idea that the Hamiltonian vanishes. He had a problem with the idea that you'd have things commuting with...
He was the first person to deal with it, I think. Actually, I'm not quite sure. It comes up, really, if you try and quantize gravity. There's no particular need to do a Hamiltonian theory with a classical theory. I don't know who tried to quantize gravity first, Bergman or Dirac.
Oh, it was Bergman. Dirac's was quite late, actually, 58.
That was my impression also, yes. Thank you. And the problem of a Hamiltonian theory with such strong constraints was handled more geometrically by Dirac, so it could be understood.
Yeah, so I mean, Dirac was looking at just Lorentz invariant theories when he's doing those lectures on constraints. Uh-huh. Okay, so you didn't have any hand in the running of the relativity seminars. It was just all Schiller and...
I believe not.
...and Anderson.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how much of Wheeler's idea of geons and getting spin half from funny topological solutions fed into your work, or whether you were already...
Well, he didn't say topological, I don't think. Geon was just a collection of a light field bound by its gravitational field.
Oh, but, yeah. Then he sort of had...
Oh, wormholes and
so. Yeah, exactly. So it sort of drifted from that into a more general program. And the way I saw it, Wheeler was after spin half, basically.
Uh-huh.
So he had Dieter Brill working on trying to get spin half.
I see. So I didn't know that. Or maybe I did and I forgot.
Yeah, I'm curious because it seems like you were sort of doing work that was directly relevant to what Wheeler was after.
Right.
From what I could see, but maybe I'm just curious why Misner didn't relay that as well. Also, the spin without spin title, was that yours? Because that sounds quite Wheelerish. It's a Wheelerism, isn't it?
I don't know. I don't think I would have put it that way. That's a Wheelerism.
It's a Wheelerism. Actually, this is from Dieter Brill's notes. So I had a bunch of his notes where he'd taken titles down. So maybe he'd just come up with that title, being a Wheeler student.
Right.
Yeah. Do you remember Oscar Klein being there? He visited Stevens around March 1958.
Who?
Oscar Klein.
My goodness. No, I don't.
So he was talking about five-dimensional relativity and Eddington.
Uh-huh.
You don't remember that one? And who else do we have? Arthur Kamar. He was at Stevens as well for a bit, right?
I should have mentioned his name. Well, he wasn't at Stevens.
Oh, he was Syracuse, wasn't he?
I know him mainly from Yeshiva.
Ah, he went there, okay.
We were colleagues there for many years.
Yeah, so I mean, did you discuss his... Because he had his own particular approach where he was trying to get coordinates, physical invariant coordinates for general relativity. Did you discuss that approach with him? Did you buy into any of
it? I'm sure I did. Comer and I spoke quite often. And I think his idea of the general relativistic Hamiltonian and its dependence on the observer.
Hmm.
I think they're right on. And people looking for the right stress tensor are probably misguided, trying to make general relativity too much like special relativity.
Hmm.
I think Arthur understood that very well.
So you didn't get tempted by any of the other approaches? Because obviously Bergman's school must have been quite a strong...
They're all working classical space-time.
Mm.
And that's drowning the baby in the bathwater.
Yeah. See, who else was doing kind of pure approaches to quantum gravity at the time? Or
by pure, you mean
quantum space-time gravity.
Space-time,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. I mean,
so I've tried to trace back the story of quantum space-time specifically, and not connected especially to general relativity. Heisenberg was probably the first to suggest it, and his idea was carried by people along paths that are pretty well defined.
Yeah, I think now there's the Snyder paper, right? Hartland Snyder's paper.
Vess is a very good man to speak to on this question of how the ideas got from Heisenberg to Snyder to in Russia.
Ivanenko? Dmitry Ivanenko?
Ivanenko, exactly, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
And finally to Yang. Finally, because I think
he had this lattice thing, didn't he? A lattice theory. Is that right?
No.
I'm thinking of Lee.
Yang looked at what Snyder had done.
I didn't know that.
And it's either the same year or the next. I think it's a very important paper. Yang published it in 1941. I believe, or was... No, sorry, 47. 41 was when Feynman tackled quantum space-time and didn't publish as far as I know, or as far as he knew.
Mm.
The idea of expressing space-time in terms of spins, as far as I know, begins with Feynman. There's a formula he wrote down while he was still a graduate student, before he went to work for Beta
mm-hmm.
on QED. Then the X equals gamma 1 plus gamma 2. X is the sum of a lot of gammas. That's obviously the Lorentz invariant. And he showed me that when I was at Yeshiva. I was sidetracked a little bit by the phenomenon of ball lightning. That came out of the plasma groups. Namely, one of the Russians thought that ball lightning might be a natural fusion reactor held together by its own magnetic field. And so I generalized the virial theorem to relativistic theory and showed that the pressure inside a configuration of plasma and electric field, electromagnetic fields, couldn't exceed the pressure outside. There was no significant confinement. And I've lost my chain of thought now.
We were talking about the development of quantum space-time and then Feynman.
Quantum space-time, right.
At Yeshiva. And so Feynman had this approach in his notebook, but he didn't. He told you about it at Yeshiva. It's strange how
I don't quite see why I drifted off onto.
Because it looked like he had a
ball lightning.
Oh, because you were doing that at Yeshiva as well.
Right.
You got.
Yes, I was explaining how I came to be in Feynman's office.
Yeah.
Namely, I went out to measure the conductivity of the rocks beneath the Mojave Desert. And since I was in Pasadena, I just took a chance and went to Feynman's office. And he wasn't there, but as I was leaving it, he was approaching it. And I recognized him and introduced myself. And he said, "Oh, the rabbi." Which is not exactly a good description, but he associated me with Yeshiva University.
Okay.
And he took me to his office, and much as I was afraid of imposing on his time, he kept me there for hours. And it was one of the experiences of my life. And I showed him a little bit about quantum logic, which he enjoyed. And he showed me this formula, and he asked me, why I think he gave it up. And I didn't have the nerve to say, if I'd been Feynman, I would have said, "You sold out for the Nobel Prize." And said, I couldn't imagine. And he said, "Because it's too difficult." Okay. That's how I came to the Feynman formula. And it really affected my subsequent work greatly.
So is that what you call a Bergman manifold?
Pardon?
A Bergman manifold. This idea that Feynman had.
A what manifold?
Bergman. Bergmann.
Why would that be called a Bergman manifold?
Well, a manifold with spins.
No, he didn't have a manifold that you put spins on. No, his formula is X itself is a sum of spin operators.
Right, okay.
That's not... In a Bergman manifold, you have the same X as any other manifold,
right.
And then you put spins, which are other independent variables, on top of them.
Right.
Now, this I call a Feynman space-time, where the points themselves are assemblies of spins. And he did this in 1941. And I think I saw that formula in a footnote to one of his papers, but I can't trace it. And he thought so too, and he couldn't trace it. He didn't write it as x equals sigma gamma. He wrote it as x equals gamma 1 plus gamma 2 and so on. And those 1s and 2 aren't the usual subscripts on the gamma. Usually it was gamma of 1, gamma of 2. They're spin operators. They're different spin operators, presumably commuting with each other.
Yeah, it's funny. Feynman does seem to have done general relativity throughout, but just not published on it. He mentions in various places in his correspondence he's been working hard on general relativity, but you don't see it anywhere.
Well, he did publish a little. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, in the late 50s and early 60s, but he'd been working on it for a long time before that, apparently.
Yes.
I also found in his notebooks with Ted Welton when he was at MIT, they worked through Eddington's book, actually, and they even discussed quantum gravity. And Theodore Welton says, let's try and do quantum gravity, and Feynman writes in the margin, way too hard, back then as well. But he kept coming back to it.
Anyway, after Feynman, the next important paper along these lines, for me, of course, is Snyder. Mm. And then Yang looks at Snyder, sees that the Lie algebra is not very pretty, and mathematically speaking, it's not simple. I'm not sure it's even semi-simple. No, it isn't. It's singular. The basic quadratic form, the pointing, the killing form, is singular. And he fixes it. He suggests that a rotation group like SO51, for example, would have among its generators operators that could serve not only for the operators of the Poincaré group, like momentum and rotation, but also the coordinates themselves, the x's, could be rotation operators in this higher dimensional space. So he's looking now not at a symmetry group so much as a dynamical group of variables. SO51. He never actually pinned down whether it's SO51 or SO33, but some six-dimensional group of which necessarily has an indefinite metric could be what underlies not the Poincaré group, but the Heisenberg-Poincaré-Lie algebra, the algebra you need for a particle in space-time. This was before gauge theory was the rage. Wigner defined a particle as a representation of the Poincaré group, but you can't do gauge physics if you don't have an X operator, and his particles didn't have X's. They just had the Poincaré operators. If you built an X, it wouldn't be an observable. It wouldn't even be local. Yang was really ahead of his time, insisting that particles have to have X's, not just the Poincaré group, as if he's getting ready to do Yang-Mills theory. You can't do a gauge theory without X's. Okay, so Yang put down this rather beautiful theory, postulating simple Lie groups, but in my opinion, he lost his nerve halfway through. He represented these groups in the same way Snyder did in Hilbert space, whose unitary group is not simple. So he's looking through into the magic garden of simple groups, but he's not willing to go there yet. And then later I spoke at his institute at Stony Brook and described his earlier work. None of the students had ever heard of it.
I can't believe I've never heard of this.
Pardon?
I can't believe I've not heard of this paper. I've trawled everywhere looking for this type of work, and I know Shields' paper on the discrete approaches, but I've never even heard of this.
Right. There's very few people have. I think it's a crucial paper. It's the first simple group. And now, if you simply combine Yang and Feynman, instead of representing his group with a Hilbert space, you simply represent it with a bunch of spins.
Mm-hmm.
The spins are now spins of SO51 or SO33. You put your money on your on your bet and you take your chances. I waffle. Sometimes, some days I use SO33, and some days I use SO51. I have a general prejudice of mathematical origin in favor of neutral metrics.
Okay.
Learned from Cantor, who based his theory of spinners on neutral metrics.
Cartan,
thank you. I keep confusing Cantor and Cartan. They're almost anagrams.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a little bit dyslexic.
Yeah. Okay. How are you feeling in terms of? We've been going for 2 hours. It's pretty good going. So I mean, where did I want to get to? I'd like to say a bit more about yeshiva. Talk a bit more about yeshiva, and the space-time code stuff would be good. And I don't know. I'm happy to go that far. If you want to carry on and talk about more things, that's fine.
No,
that's
fine.
Good.
And
I don't want to keep you too long. And, the ball lightning thing got me curious. How did that actually come about? How did you decide?
Well, there was this Russian proposal that ball. I was in plasma. Ball lightning is a natural thermonuclear reactor, maybe. So I had to look into it.
Oh, so you were sort of officially working on plasma physics?
At yeshiva.
Right.
At a laboratory.
Okay, I didn't know that.
I was trying to make a relativistic pinch.
Ah, okay, right. That makes sense now.
A Budker machine.
Yeah.
A linear one, to begin with.
Yeah.
And
I noticed you returned.
There, I think it was at the CERN that I there was one more bit of apprenticeship, namely there's a question of the underlying field of quantum theory. If you're generalizing, you have to consider all the possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And
you mean number
Virchow and Neumann had pointed out that RC and the quaternions are the natural fields for projective geometry. And quaternions are attractive because they're even more non-commutative, more quantum, than the real and complex quantum theories.
Yeah.
So at Geneva, I worked with Speiser and Yao on quaternion quantum mechanics and immediately ran into the problem that there's no respectable theory of the tensor product over the quaternion field, which means you can't do statistics
mm-hmm.
without breaking the symmetry, breaking the field down to the complex or the reals. And you can write Schrodinger's equation, but then it involves singling out an I. Or the Heisenberg equation of motion singles out an I.
So what's the problem of doing tensor products?
Tensor product of two vector spaces can be expressed in terms of functions which are linear, which are bilinear in both factors separately. A bilinear function over the quaternions vanishes identically, because if you can multiply the first coefficient by I and the second by first space by I, the second by J, or you can multiply the first by J.
Okay.
And you're
yeah.
supposed to get
yeah,
the same
yeah,
thing
yeah.
either way, and you don't. If you do, you get zero.
Yeah.
And you have to break the symmetry. You have to single out one quaternion, and if you want to preserve the quaternionic symmetry, then you have to introduce a new physical variable
that will distinguish it.
You could say there's an imaginary unit which depends on space and time in the way that the gravitational field gives you a local Lorentz group but breaks the global one.
Mm.
So you'd have a local quaternion group, but you'd break the global one. So it's a gauge theory, and this singling out of the eye leads to a gauge boson with mass. I'm afraid I'm another one of the infinite number of people who did the Higgs field before right. Higgs. But I gather the fact that I used quaternion language meant that nobody could read the paper. Those were the golden days. Right. Now physicists are too well educated in mathematics.
You didn't go there to work with Yoke, though, right? You were working on something completely different. And did you know about Yoke?
Did I know about?
About Yoke and Spicer before?
I didn't know them before I went to CERN, no.
So how did you get to working with these guys?
Well, of course, I didn't give up my interests. Yoke had written this marvelous book on electrodynamics.
So he'd already...
I knew of him. I just went out of my way to meet him, and I showed him my work on quantum logic, and he was one of the few people who, in fact, he's probably the only reputable physicist who listened to me. Oh, Feynman.
Yeah. So during that
Feynman
stage,
came later. He was at the time the only one.
It's 'cause especially in CERN, things were going very heavily data-driven, right? So PS just started, I suppose.
Yeah, wasn't at CERN so much. He was at the University of Geneva.
Right.
He was much more theoretical.
Okay. So, I mean, do you remember how this kind of work was viewed at the time?
I wasn't in the particle group. I had virtually no interaction with them. I was often...
Where were you based? Did you have an office?
The Accelerated Development Group.
And you had, like, shared office?
I had an office there. I don't think we shared. I think I had my own office. And David Spicer and I would meet there sometimes, and sometimes at the university.
And were you giving talks or anything at CERN? Was there a kind of research meeting group there at CERN?
I published in the CERN series.
There's
a sequence of three or four papers on quaternion quantum mechanics, which are in printable in their archives. You should be able to look them up.
If you do, they're
photographically garbled. There isn't a complete set of...
I think I'm missing two.
Maybe. And the bottom of the pages is missing and so on.
Yeah, it's like a multi-part series, right?
But it got published later. What's the name of this Australian philosopher?
Hooker. Cliff Hooker.
Cliff Hooker put the whole quaternion sequence in one of his...
Yeah, the quantum logic book.
Right. Do you ever see Cliff Hooker?
I do, actually. I've seen him quite recently. I just did something for a book he's edited, in fact. On complex systems.
Give him my regard.
I will.
I really like him very much. I'm sorry we're out of touch.
I had no idea you knew Cliff Hooker, but yeah.
I think we got on well.
He's a nice guy. So did this set you back on the path of the logic of quantum?
The quantum mechanics helped me. Because you look at the lattices and so on, you have to make sure, you really have to think about quantum mechanics fresh if you change the underlying number system.
Cause
it was very helpful.
It looked like you were sort of drifting to general relativistic things, and then CERN happens, and these papers happen, and then you change direction, really, is what it looks like from the publication.
I wasn't drifting to the general relativity thing. Was purely an exercise on the way to quantized space-time.
Yeah.
I'd hoped to show you couldn't get spin a half from general relativity. Turns out you can, but the hell with it. That's not where it comes from.
Yeah.
I mean, the real problem was to quantize space-time. It would be nice to know you had to, but you still have to.
Okay, so was there any kind of overlap between Stevens and Yeshiva? It seems like
Joel Leibowitz was the first to go from Stevens to Yeshiva. He was the first physicist they hired, and he created the department and with Leopard Head from the very beginning, and he hired me from Stevens, and we're still good friends.
And you just, was it a teaching institute then? Were you teaching, or was it grad students?
It was the Belford Graduate School of Science.
Right. So you were teaching courses to grad students.
Right, and I taught undergraduates also.
Right.
That involved crossing the street.
What was that?
That involved crossing the street.
Okay, to go to the other.
Amsterdam Avenue runs right through the campus, and the religious buildings are on one side, and the School of Science is on the other.
Yeah, actually, Susskind, in one of his books, paints a nice picture of of the early days of yeshiva, and it's very highly orthodox. And,
not highly orthodox, but if they were highly orthodox, we wouldn't have been there.
Right.
They run the Albert Einstein College of Medicine.
Susskind says that you arranged his job interview, actually. Is that right? Did you interview him or just...
Yeah, I was out in California. We met. And he's obviously promising.
Mm.
And we were very lucky that he agreed to come.
So he must have been working on... Was he working on hadrons? And was he an S-matrix guy? I forget whether he was doing S-matrix stuff. I know he was doing...
I think he was already into string theory.
I think, no, so string theory, so he said, I think he went there in about 67, he said, so string theory is 68, you get the dual resonance model stuff, and then 69 is when Susskind writes his strings paper, so I'm just wondering what... he's working on hadrons.
Sometimes people work for years on an idea before they publish. And there's work on the S-matrix, which compares the amplitudes for two experiments, which can really be easily related to each other, only if you think of them as string interactions.
Yeah. The DHS duality, the Rosner-Harari kind of...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he was either doing that when we met or very soon after.
Okay, so he was already looking along those lines. That's interesting. Yeah, okay. Because I thought he waited for the Veneziano paper and only then started looking at that, but it sounds like
it could
maybe
be.
He...
My impression is that he was doing that kind of deformation early.
So other people there, I suppose you had Dirac there for a while, did...
His office was next to mine.
Ah, okay. Did you speak?
Once.
That's quite a lot compared to...
Just couldn't stop gabbing.
So what was that about, quantum gravity or anything?
Yeah. We quickly came to the... Turn the conversation quickly to the question of which is more the fundamental physical constant, E or H.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave an argument. I guess I knew about it before, and maybe I brought it up because I don't believe it. And he said that E must be more fundamental. And his argument is that if H were more fundamental, the formula for E would involve a square root.
Right.
Is a square root of 137.
It's a very Eddingtonian.
HC. And fundamental laws can't involve square roots. But from my work in quaternion quantum mechanics, I already knew that E never appears in physics. In fact, in Weyl's book on electromagnetism, he absorbs an E into the vector potential, so it's not there in the coupling between the vector potential and the electron, and it appears then only in one place, in front of the Maxwell action. And of course, it appears there as E squared.
Mm.
And physically, how could E appear by itself? You only know about it through forces between two E's. And he heard me out politely and said, nevertheless, he still thinks that E is more fun. He's not going to look for a formula expressing E in terms of H and C, but he's going to try and express H in terms of E and C. And that mm-hmm. means he didn't think quantum theory was fundamental.
Mm.
Beneath it, he thinks there's a more classical kind of theory, and that H, maybe like Einstein thought, represents instabilities in the classical nonlinear field.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, shown in his book on quantum theory, which is epical, but is not operational. He never says what operations correspond to his state vector any more than von Neumann does. And it's perfectly clear from Heisenberg's work that the state vector represents an input port or input beam, and the dual is the output beam. Mm-hmm. And the basic Born formula is a description of the experiment. Just a very pragmatic theory. And anyone who thinks it needs an interpretation just means he hasn't absorbed its interpretation. But you couldn't be checking it against experiment as beautifully as we do if it didn't come with its interpretation. So any paper on the interpretation of quantum physics is a confession by the author, I don't understand quantum theory. There's a paper to this effect in the Physics Today by a good friend of mine, unfortunately deceased, from Israel.
Is it a philosopher?
No, a physics major.
Perez.
Again?
Asher Perez.
Exactly,
yeah.
Thank you. You're inexhaustible.
Yeah, I know that paper.
He had a paper saying quantum theory needs no interpretation.
Yeah, yeah.
He's right on. Except I don't think he gives the interpretation. It's okay, can't get everything.
No, but he did have that viewpoint in mind,
right.
Actually. Yeah. So, did you host Penrose as well? And I heard Aronov was there? Was Aronov there when you were there?
May have passed through.
He wasn't a visitor.
He wasn't on the faculty. And who do you ask about?
Aronov. Yakir.
Yes. Aronov got his first job outside Israel at Yeshiva.
Uh-huh.
Essentially, he was sent by Bohm, whom I still respect, and was happy at Yeshiva for quite a few years.
Mm. Actually, on Bohm, did you have any interactions with Bohm?
Oh, very strong.
Was he a visitor? I mean, he had trouble in...
Not at Yeshiva.
No.
But when I spent a sabbatical at Oxford, Bohm would come down from London very often. And we'd walk by the river and talk for hours.
Yeah, I stumbled across a paper of his recently from, I think it was late 60s, where he had an almost causal set kind of approach as well. Have you seen this paper? I should send it to you if you don't know it. There's some very, very similar ideas to some of the
other
stuff.
I was especially influenced by his thinking about simplicial complexes. He recognized that the use of that Grassmann algebras were really theories of simplicial complexes. I don't think this was a very common idea at the time. If you look in Chevalier's book on modern concepts, he points out that the theory of simplicial complexes is an exercise in Grassmann algebra.
Mm.
And what Bohm adds to that is that means it must have to do with Fermi statistics. And he's right on. I once asked him how he could possibly do his work on causal theories of quantum theory and yet have this understanding of quantum theory. And he explained he wasn't trying to get rid of quantum theory. He was trying to show there must be levels beneath it.
Mm.
And gestures, then why was he making them look so classical? I mean, it looked more like a return to old thoughts than pursuing the revolutionary road.
Mm.
And he never answered. But his theory, like all the other attempts to make classical interpretations of Psi, fail on one question. If Psi is really an object, a physical thing out there, how come it acts as a statistical distribution?
Mm.
How come it gives probabilities? This is the failure of all those theories to close. That one last link is missing.
So, Susskind mentions he remembers you having a debate with Dirac, actually, at some stage.
I think the one I just mentioned.
No, it was a different one, where you were arguing about the zero-point energy of empty space and whether it gravitates, and whether it should gravitate, and how that should be treated. Do you remember having that discussion?
Let me think. I don't remember that. If I remembered it, I would cherish it.
So he mentions this in God, which one is it?
I can certainly see that happening.
Yeah,
it seems to me that Dirac's theory makes that zero point energy very natural. It breaks the symmetry
between
electron and positron. The vacuum is full of these things,
yeah.
And Heisenberg's symmetrization is a bit of a gimmick. He's throwing away at infinity, so you can get any answer you like.
Mm.
Why should there be perfect symmetry between the two? It's begging the question. It's just saying that let's set the gravitational field equal to zero, never mind what it really is.
Yeah. Okay, I think I'm nearly done, actually. The space-time code papers. So, I mean, were these... How do you view this first space-time code paper? Was it sort of a culmination?
I was trying to get across the idea of the world as a computer. And the more I think about that, that could be taken too shallowly, too simplistically.
Mm.
But in classical physics, you don't have input-output systems. You talk about the way the world is. In computers, you have an input and you have an output, or you don't have a computer. And in quantum theory, you have an input and output, or you don't have a quantum theory. So you're much closer to the computer model than to the old Platonic model of what physics is about. And I guess my paper on the world as computer is the first appearance in literature of the idea of a quantum computer. In a paper I gave... on one of those island meetings, Corsica. It's in a book edited by David Speiser. I suggested that nature is a computer and the individual electron spins, or individual spins are the bits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the idea of the quantum memory, but my quantum computer is more quantum than the industrial ones. Namely, the addresses are quantum too. The usual commercial quantum computers are located at macroscopic, the bits are located at macroscopic positions with classical addresses.
In the space-time code paper, though, you don't have that kind of interpretation of quantum computer.
I think when I wrote that paper, first of all, it was before I met Feynman. So the idea that these abstract spin-half bits were actually spins was not comfortable for me. I'd like to go slower.
Mm.
That avoids making mistakes, but it avoids a lot of inventions too. And I first had the courage to identify these things with spins after my meeting with Feynman.
So is that the paper where you get special relativity out, the geometry of special relativity from quantum mechanics?
getting it out, I mean, I knew it before. Let's be realistic. Maybe building it in is another way to put it.
Right. I'll show it. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, a prediction, you can't predict things you already know.
Tell that to the string theorists. Actually, did you not?
But that, I guess, I wrote that paper before meeting Weisskopf. Sorry, before meeting Weizsäcker, yeah. I meant to say. Yeah. And he and I were both influenced by the recognition that the group of special relativity is SL2C,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which is the group of a bit.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Okay, and it was completely independent there. Yeah.
He quoted rather often at his talks my statement that he was the first person to recognize this identity, and he would then say that I could say that because I had done it independently.
Okay. Did you not get tempted by some of the goings-on in string theory? So Susskind got quite into string theory early on.
I had this horrible 2 years after I discovered what I called kinks,
mm-hmm.
the solitons of the gravitational field. Because they're finite objects, how could they blow up?
Mm.
And it took a ridiculously long time for me to realize that there was still an infinite number of degrees of freedom, that there was still a high-frequency spectrum, that you can't make a physics just of kinks. And so there'd always be divergences in a continuous field theory. But still, for a while, the idea of doing a purely topological physics appealed to me. And in the paper by Misner and me on topological conservation laws, a vibrating string was the simplest example of solitons. Sorry, wasn't the string, it was a strip.
Yes, that's right. And you did a twist. It was like you gave
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was tempted by such ideas, but if you like, the Lie algebras aren't simple. They violate Yang's principle.
So that was, because in fact...
They use Hilbert space. They're as bad as any other field theory. And they pretend that there's this cancellation between the fermion and the boson because they have two infinities.
Mm.
Isn't infinity minus infinity zero? If you want zero, it's zero, sure. But it's the most stupid cancellation I've ever seen.
Were you aware of the mathematical side of string theory? Because the business of the monster sporadic group and Leech lattices and all of that kind of thing.
I didn't
follow
that at all.
Yeah.
No. Susskind kept me in touch with Witten's developing ideas,
mm-hmm.
and they all seem to be mathematicians' fantasies. They don't come out of experiment. And both general relativity and quantum theory, of course,
mm-hmm.
are thoroughly based on very important experiments. There hasn't been a case, really, where a good theory was invented out of nothing. Maybe in his later years, Einstein drifted away from experiment.
Yeah.
But when he was making his great discoveries, he was thinking very, very hard about solid experiments, even Galileo's.
Mm. So what's your view of... Do you follow present-day quantum gravity approaches much?
Well, most of them use classical space-time, it could be lattice or it be a manifold.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't been following them much. I keep in touch with blocking names again. Ashtekar and Smolin.
Yeah.
And
the loop approach.
Right. And I really can't find the theory. I've tried to get it formulated as a mathematical theory, but it seems to be more of a program. And it just, they have a different program. But loops sound like there's a continuum down there, that they're using, unless they've changed the word loop beyond.
Yeah, it's not loop anymore. They have essentially spin networks. It's called, so they have SU2.
Right, and
representations.
I believe the spin network still uses classical addresses, so to speak.
So the idea is, what they say is, this is Rovelli. He says you have a manifold.
If they really believe that spin network, that means they have a discrete space-time.
That's what they think. So they use a manifold as an auxiliary device to set the theory up, and then
nothing in my sleeves.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I think we'll end there. That's excellent. Thank you.